from the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. El Salvador has a population of a little more than 6 million people, less than New York City. But the violence in the Central American country is out of control. It has a murder rate 22 times higher than that of the United States. One recent month saw more than 900 homicides. By comparison, in all of 2015, New York had 352. Many blame the country's two main gang groups, MS-13 and rival Barrio 18. The rival groups are constantly warring with each other in turf battles, with the people of El Salvador caught in the middle. Truces have failed time and again, and the government has gone as far as labeling the two groups terrorists. On this edition of Global Journalist, we look at a country that was once torn apart by a civil war in the 1980s and how it's being threatened by a very different kind of war. Joining us this week from New York City, Danny Gold, a reporter and producer for Vice News. His documentary, Gangs of El Salvador, was released in November 2015. From Washington, D.C., Stephen Dudley, co-director for Insight Crime, an organization that studies organized crime in Latin America and the Caribbean. And from Miami, Jose Miguel Cruz, director of research at the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. Jose Miguel Cruz, I want to welcome you first. Tell us, if you would, how did El Salvador come out of this civil war in the 1992 and come to be so shaken by this problem of street gangs?
Well, there were many factors that influenced this, you know, generation of gangs in El Salvador. To start with, many people who during the war have migrated to the United States. When the war ended, many of those families came back to El Salvador, and with those families, a lot of young people who had joined gangs or who had joined street gangs in Southern California in the United States, they brought the culture of gang membership of the United States to El Salvador.
So, in other words, this culture was imported from the United States back into El Salvador.
Yes, in fact, you know, the major gangs in El Salvador, MS-13 and the 18th Street Gang, those gangs were formed in the United States, and their names correspond to gangs that were formed in Southern California. So they brought this culture back to El Salvador, but in El Salvador, they also found you know the right conditions for these kind of groups to expand, right? A lot of poverty, inequality, a lot of violence is still on the streets, and that made the right conditions for young people who were searching for identity, for searching for some reference groups to basically expand the gangs in El Salvador and in general in Northern Central America as well.
And Danny Gold in New York City, thanks very much for joining us from Vice News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you made a documentary about the gangs of El Salvador. We're going to listen to just a brief clip from your documentary right now.
It's 3 a.m. in San Salvador, and police are rounding up gang members. Dozens of cops are spreading out all over the poor neighborhood of Soyapango.
They're about to go house to house right now. They've got search warrants and they're looking for gang members.
Inside, a man is handcuffed. His tattoo is proof of his membership in the 18th Street Gang, otherwise known as Diaz y Ocho.
And Danny, as a foreigner, when you visit El Salvador, how do you see and feel the presence of gangs on the street?
Well, it's interesting. You know, if you're going to go into certain neighborhoods, you can't without permission from the gangs. But it's not like they're an everyday constant presence that you see. They're around and you feel them, but you'll have lookouts. You know, we went to the markets to interview people about extortion. You know, it's not like there are guys with face tattoos standing on every market corner, but there's a 12-year-old kid there who's communicating with those guys and letting them know everything that's happened. In terms of how you feel, you know, for us foreigners especially, it's a bit unnerving, but the threat isn't there completely. They're not targeting us. What's more worrisome is the local journalists, people who work for El Faro, or the people that are helping us, our fixers, or local people that are showing us around, you know, they're targets. They can disappear, they can be killed, and there won't be as much of a sort of controversy as if a foreigner gets killed. So you really have to worry about them and their safety and what could happen to them potentially if you overstep your bounds. It's still a situation where, you know, if you kill a foreigner, especially a foreign journalist, it's going to attract a lot of unwarranted attention to your gang. So I think for the most part, they look to avoid that. But these guys who, you know, these Salvadoran reporters are there day in, day out. These gang members know where they live. So it's much more of a problem for them than it is for me, someone who goes to the country for 2 weeks and then comes back home.
And Stephen Dudley in Washington, D.C., welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And you've done a lot of research on why young people in Central America join gangs. And it sounds like just an incredibly violent and difficult lifestyle. People are regularly killed sort of as part of the initiation process, it sounds like. So what is the attraction?
Well, I think the attraction is like joining any group, really. I don't think that we need to sort of, you know, stretch our imaginations to understand why people would join gangs. They join gangs because they want friends, they listen to the same music, they live in the same neighborhood, their friends have already joined, you know, and then there's the allure of power. Power is really important to anyone, not just to these kids, but certainly power. And it's not just power to sort of, you know, extort, is what Danny was talking about, or, you know, having friends and things that come with that. But it's power also to feel like you're safe. I mean, you know, part of what is joining a gang is also sort of, you know, self-preservation. So, you know, there are a mix of many different elements that go into joining a gang, but let's not pretend that it couldn't happen to anybody, and that we don't join groups for the same reasons that these kids join these groups that are around them.
And Jose Miguel Cruz in Miami, there was a recent study by El Salvador's central bank and by the United Nations that estimated that something like 16% of the country's GDP is lost due to extra security or lost work or simply extortion from these organized criminal groups. And you lived in El Salvador and studied this issue. For ordinary people there, how do they experience the presence of street gangs in their country?
Well, for many people, gangs generate a lot of insecurity, right? As you said, violence is very high in El Salvador. The murder rate last year was 103 deaths per 100,000. So this is a huge rate, almost comparable to a place at war, right? So these gangs, the violence they produce, as well as other actors, the violence that other actors produce, including state forces, generate insecurity among the population. And also because gangs tend to extort, as Stephen said, gangs tend to extort the population, right? They have these sort of what they call, in some cases, war taxes, in which people have to pay them in order to remain safe or to remain secure or not to be threatened by gangs. So that generates also a lot of insecurity. People who cannot pay the gangs usually are at peril, right, at risk. So they have to pay, even people who have very low income, they have to pay something to the local gang or to some other gangs who patrol the zone, right, the region, the neighborhood where they live. So this obviously generates a lot of insecurity. People don't trust each other in some communities because of the levels of violence. So it's rather a harsh environment for many Salvadorians.
I want to remind our listeners that this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at the out-of-control gang violence in El Salvador and what the government and other groups are trying to do to slow the rising body count. Our guest this week from New York City, Danny Gold, a correspondent for Vice News. His documentary, Gangs of El Salvador, was released last year. From Washington, D.C., Stephen Dudley, co-director of Insight Crime, a research organization that covers organized crime in Latin America and the Caribbean. And from Miami, Jose Miguel Cruz, Director of Research at the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. And Danny Gold, tell us just a little bit about what the differences are between these Central American, these Salvadoran gangs, and, you know, maybe some of their better known organized criminal groups like the Mexican cartels or even the Colombian cartels that were so famous in the 1980s and 90s.
You know, I'm not really an expert on the other cartels, but I can sort of give you the impression that I had. When I went down there, it seemed like, you know, a lot of these guys were just sort of like kids, 15, 16-year-old kids in tank tops and mesh shorts, very unorganized, very sort of almost nihilistic. But I left with a different impression. That was that they really have everything in the country completely controlled. They know who's coming in. They know who's going out. Everything is under surveillance. The way they recruit is like down to science. So, you know, your first impression of these guys are going to be they're a bunch of street thugs that are just willing to shoot anyone, anywhere. And there's an element of that that's true, but they actually are very, very well organized. I know they have an international presence in the U.S., but I don't think they're as globally connected as you would have the Colombian cartels or the Mexican cartels be. I don't think they're nearly as profitable as those gangs are, because they don't, you know, they don't control major either cocaine production or disbursement in the U.S. But I think it's a mistake to view them as completely disorganized or as sort of amateurs. They are very, very dangerous. I'm sure Stephen though could definitely talk more about how they compare.
Well, Stephen, let me turn this to you then. What differences do you see between these Central American gangs and Mexican cartels or Colombian cartels?
These are subsistence-based organizations. They're hand-to-mouth. I mean, they have bank accounts of $5,000 to $10,000, not bank accounts of $5 to $10 million. So this is apples and oranges. The ethos of these gangs is about the gang. The gang itself is the most important piece of their lives. It's not the sort of end game of being a criminal economic enterprise, which is the end game of these large cartels. The end game of the gang is to be part of the gang, is to respect the gang, is to show homage to the gang. That is the essence of their existence. Part of that has to do with maintaining a violent rivalry with other gangs, which is why we have these long-standing feuds that play out over years and over many different geographic spaces and countries, is because it is part and parcel of the gang. They have to have these violent relationships within themselves and against somebody else. But that is a very different endgame than a drug cartel that is basically, attempting to be an economic entity.
So in other words, there's no Pablo Escobar type figure with mansions all over the world and giraffes in its own game park.
Not even close. These are hand-to-mouth organizations. They're hand-to-mouth leaders. The leaderships are running these things. They're for the most part small-time schemes. Now, having said that, there is a maturation process happening now in the region, and some portions of these gangs have attempted to break into other criminal activities, such as being major distributors of drugs within countries, and even in some respects trying to transport drugs from one point to another within their countries. But we don't have any cases in which a gang has moved, for example, a quantity of cocaine from El Salvador to the streets of Maryland. There are no cases that are like that. Do they commit transnational criminal acts? Yes. We have a case in Boston that speaks to this, and this has to do with, basically ordering assassinations as a reorganization of the gang and also their attempts to gain turf within that area against other gangs. These are transnational criminal acts, but we're not having this sort of type of coordination that you see within a drug trafficking organization yet. Now, they're maturing. They're attempting to mature. Some pieces are attempting to mature. but they're not there yet.
Well, Jose Miguel Cruz, let me turn this to you to raise a different point, because I understand that actually El Salvador's jails and its sort of prison policy had sort of a dramatic effect on the evolution of gang culture in El Salvador. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the problems with the gangs in El Salvador and the way these gangs evolved in El Salvador is because of the policies implemented by the different Salvadorian governments, right? Starting in the early 2000s. Basically, what in the early 2000s, although there were already gangs in El Salvador, there were already MS-13, 18 street gangs, they weren't as problematic as they are today. But the government, in a move to basically improve its chances in the elections in early 2000s, basically decided to pursue these mano dura policies, these zero tolerance policies, that basically put a lot of gang members or young people, even young people who weren't involved in gangs, they put them in prisons. And they created this sort of one single gang prison. So we have prisons just for MS-13, prisons for an 18 street gang. And by doing this, the government what the government did was to provide them with opportunities for these gangs to organize, to elect leaderships, and to prepare for this war against the government. You have to remember that in many of these prisons, basically the gang members are put in there and then forget about them. The government forgets about them, and whatever happens in the prisons is basically depends on the gang themselves. There is no control over what is happening in the prison. So the gangs have this opportunity to do whatever they want from prisons. 24/7, and they use these sort of spaces to organize and to strengthen their control over the territories outside the prison.
And it sounds like these prisons, in a way, almost became like a corporate headquarters for these gangs.
Absolutely, yes. One gang member once told me as a permanent assembly, the permanent congress of the gang, right? All the leaders were there, all their representatives were there, so they took decisions over there, and they basically passed those decisions to the street. So that's how they started to organize and started to, as Steven said, sort of mature, and as Danny said, they started to coordinate actions. Right, they develop these systems of controlling territory in a very effective way.
I just want to remind our listeners that this is Global Journalist. I'm your host, Jason McClure. This week, we're talking to three experts about the ongoing problem of gang violence in El Salvador. Joining us from New York City, Danny Gold, a reporter and producer for Vice News. In 2015, he went to El Salvador to report on the gang violence and its effect on people living there. From Washington, D.C., Stephen Dudley, co-director for Insight Crime, an organization that looks at and studies organized crime in Latin America and the Caribbean. And from Miami, Jose Miguel Cruz, director of research at the Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. If you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs and press freedom issues. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. And Danny Gold, in your film, Gangs of El Salvador, you spoke with someone who had worked to broker sort of a truce between the government and the gangs in El Salvador. Talk to us just a little bit about what the outcome of that policy was.
You know, there's a lot of debate over that. You'll find people in El Salvador who would tell you that the truce you know, it was a great thing that it led to a large decrease in the number of murders. You'll find others who will say that the truce was sort of a sham.
This was back in 2012. Sorry, is that not?
That the truce was sort of a sham. That you know, the murders went down considerably, but disappearances went up quite a bit, and that the gangs used that time to rearm and to consolidate their power. So it's sort of a mixed bag. You know, I couldn't say one way or another. though, from the people we spoke to at El Faro, which is the newspaper that does a lot of great reporting on the situation there, they seem to think the truce was working and that it really brought the murder rate down. That situation was thrown out the window recently with the implementation of the Super Mano Dura, which is sort of the government's big-time iron fist policy when they just decide to go to war with the gangs. The interesting thing about that is that, you know, you have examples of extrajudicial killings. You have really, really harsh policies that turned the murder rate really high for a while. Now it's gone down, but the people actually supported this. They were so sick and tired of dealing with the gangs that they see this as the really only way. So it's sort of a calculated thing by the government, it would appear, that they want to win elections. And the way to win an election, whether it makes the situation worse or better, is to appeal to the people who want this aggressive policy. And that's what you're seeing right now. You've seen the murder rate go down, actually, the past few months. The gangs are saying that's because they made a truce amongst themselves to stop the violence because they want to show the government that this policy isn't necessary.
And Stephen Dudley, we heard Danny talking about this sort of super hard hands policy where we do see gang members being classified as terrorists. In his film, he shows people being arrested on terrorism charges for having a gang tattoo. Talk to us just a little bit about, you know, what your view of that policy is.
Well, it's short-sighted, and it does not resolve the core issues that lead to gangs, that allow gangs to proliferate, that allow gangs to control territory. It is, you know, especially if it's not coupled with reforms in the judicial system, the prison system, as Jose Miguel was referring to, you know, it just becomes an exercise in really often repression, and it opens the door to abuses. The abuses that we have seen and have been chronicled in El Salvador include extrajudicial executions by these police, mostly police, who are sent out to deal with the gangs. It then accelerates the conflict with the gangs who have then gone back and started to kill police members, oftentimes when they're off duty, and even at times target their family members. So it has in many ways exacerbated the conflict rather than putting resources towards dealing with core issues or putting resources across the entire spectrum of the judicial system. You just focus on one aspect of it, which is repression, and your long-term results are going to be what they have been for the last decade, would be my position.
And Jose Miguel Cruz in Miami, talk to us just a little bit about what the spillover effect is in other Central American countries. How influential are these gangs in places like Honduras, Guatemala, elsewhere in the region?
Well, they are very influential in Guatemala and Honduras. Maybe not as influential as they are in El Salvador, because in El Salvador they have developed more, I would say, than in Guatemala and Honduras. But still, in Guatemala and Honduras, these countries also face a huge problem of violence, and gangs over there play an important role in that violence. However, in Guatemala and Honduras, you have other actors, you have cartels, criminal organizations that tend to be more powerful than they are in El Salvador. And the gangs usually collaborate with those criminal organizations in those countries. In El Salvador, gangs have more power, and they don't usually collaborate with the criminal organizations in the way they do in these other countries. But these three countries, and also called the Northern Triangle of Central America, face these challenges of security out of the failure of the governments to tackle the causes of violence, right? Causes usually linked to inequality, to lack of opportunities, to a huge commercialization of weapons, of small weapons, legal and illegal, and many other reasons.
And Danny Gold, one phenomenon of gang culture in El Salvador that is particularly worrisome is the treatment of women. And in particular, we've heard a number of reports about feminicides, the killing of women for just virtually no reason at all by gangs. What do we know about that?
You know, we didn't really investigate that too much when we were down there. It does seem to be a huge problem in El Salvador, especially with young women that get involved with the gang members. You know, once they are involved with one gang member, they're essentially involved with him for life. There's no way out. Especially even if that gang member dies, you know, they are seen as having to be extremely, extremely loyal to the gang. But from everything we've heard, you know, it's a big issue with women, but it's everyone in El Salvador. I think it would be a mistake to concentrate it on young people, on women. It is everyone in the country that is sort of suffering under the weight of these gangs. Everyone is targeted. No one appears to be safe.
And Stephen Dudley, our time does grow short. But what sorts of policy solutions are we looking at over the next couple of years that may be able to potentially bring this problem to heel?
Well, this is obviously the difficult question, but you can certainly try a number of different things that include focused deterrence. What we do know about violence in other parts of the world and also El Salvador to a certain extent, although not as many studies have been done there, is that oftentimes violence is really really concentrated in a few hands, not sort of as widespread as we think of it. So you can try focused deterrence on the sort of police side of things. And then you can start to bring together partnerships, private and government partnerships, that begin to alleviate the circumstances in which these gangs emerge. And that includes everything from putting money into educational programs, not just for gang members, but entire communities, and poor rural, poor urban areas, which is where these gangs are concentrated, need an incredible influx of state and private resources that they're just not getting. And so there has to be promotion of that on a constant level and over a long period of time. This thing does not resolve itself just with having Manalura, whatever you want to call it, and sending more police and military out in the streets. This resolves itself over long periods of time with lots of effort, both on the government side and on the private side, as well as civil society. So, you know, these are the things that we have to think about instead of thinking about short-term police solutions.
That's going to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Many thanks to Danny Gold, Stephen Dudley, and Jose Miguel Cruz for joining us. Our executive producer is Joshua Kranzberg. Our producers this week are Jinhong Chen and Javila Raskaskate. Our studio director is Travis McMillan of RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us here at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.